And yet I wouldn't discourage a campaign from doing some of that. Most of my brochures have pictures of the whole family, and including the kids, and they have really not a lot to do with setting a public policy in Minnesota, but hey, it shows I have a family I care about, and I think it's sincere. I mean, I don't think it's phony stuff. But hey, we had ads, we had suggestions from volunteers who want to make sure we appeal to every base, and hey, why don't you borrow our dog so you have a dog for the picture? And I mean, that's where you cross the line from just pure fluff into phoniness. But there certainly have been people in the past, military hawks, who were draft avoiders in Vietnam days. They found a way to stay out of the draft, and now they're just the pro hawks who we have to go to war and fight this. I'd suggest that the people who played a different role might more accurately portray themselves in that way. But I'll suggest that the biggest problem with campaign fluff is that it's too much of it. It's overwhelming any substance in campaigns. The second one is the negative attack stuff, personal attacks or issue attacks. There's a big difference, and it's a touchy to draw the line between what's a legitimate criticism of your opponent's stand on an issue and what's a negative attack. I think it's legitimate, very legitimate, to point out where you differ from your opponent. It's not legitimate to spend all your time attacking your opponent for being lousy on this or lousy on that. And the 30-second television spots, which are the main way most larger campaigns are run these days, are very effective when they're hard-hitting, and one person in Minnesota's, one political consultant in Minnesota's advice to legislative candidates some time ago was to use radio spots because people don't always hear them quite right, and so you hit real hard and you try and, quote, portray your opponent as the scum of the earth. That happened to backfire on that individual and the candidates he was working for because it was quoted in the paper. And people rightly don't want to see that, but nevertheless, if they don't hear the consultant telling the candidate that, they do accept a lot of that negative stuff. I think some of the most highly publicized of these negative attack ads, the Willie Horton one, which they used in the title, basically was used to portray that if Dukakis was elected president, that dangerous criminals were going to get out of prison, and we'd go out and rape and murder people in your neighborhood or on your street or in your house even. Probably the most famous of all times was the Lyndon Johnson ad, in which he had flashes of scenes of a girl and flowers and then a nuclear bomb and Barry Goldwater portrayed all in one, suggesting that if his opponent was elected, we'd have a nuclear war and goodbye, little girl. A real powerful ad suggesting his opponent was going to start a nuclear war. This past year, Jesse Helms had a very powerful ad. He was running against a black candidate, and he had an ad on the affirmative action issue, and he said it was a real powerful image. It shows a hands of a guy wearing a plaid shirt, white hands, crumpling up a piece of paper and throwing it in the garbage. The text was basically, you could have had that job. You were the best qualified, but they had to give it to a minority. And then going on to say how Jesse Helms opposes such and such a bill that would cause this thing to happen, and his opponent, Harvey Gantt, supports such a thing. What do these ads have in common? Well, I'd suggest the most common thing they have in them is an appeal to baser instincts in people. They certainly appeal to greed. this guy is going to raise your taxes. He's going to take away your hard-earned dollars. You want to hang on to your hard-earned dollars. Government's going to waste it anyway. But selfishness, what's in it for me? I'm going to give... my opponent's going to take more from you and help others more at your expense, or he's going to cheat you out of something. Second thing I'd suggest is hate or bigotry. relying on our fear of minorities, our fear of people of different ethnic or religious backgrounds. That's a common one, and fear in general. Crime is a real powerful campaign thing for negative ads about how some opponent is soft on crime is an easy one to portray in various ways. I've seen one in a newspaper ad in Minnesota where it had a guy who, some cop is letting a guy out of a jail cell, and the guy looks like the worst kind of thug you can imagine. He hasn't shaved in 3 or 4 days. He looks mean and scowly, and the ad was titled, Butch is Back on the Streets, was suggesting that this guy's opponent, who was the incumbent, was in favor of releasing dangerous criminals from prison. And that fear is a very powerful thing, and we can appeal to those fears and bigotries and greed types of emotions very effectively. I'd say that's the most common theme of the negative advertisements. Another one that I've experienced a lot of time is the two-sided talk. And that happens one of two ways, either telling different groups, telling group A, you're going to do this for that group. Often happens on an urban-rural type of setting. Oh, in Minnesota, I've seen it done against the Twin Cities area. Go to greater Minnesota and tell them, they get all the benefits of the state. Tax policy is meant to benefit them. You're paying too much tax, not getting any of the services. Then you go to the Twin Cities area and you tell them, oh, my opponent's doing something to help greater Minnesota at the expense of you, your schools or your property taxes or whatever. You're being cheated on it. Of course, the same message being told to two different groups in opposite ways is two-sided, two-faced talk. That's not fair, but it's an easy way to attack an opponent by portraying them as is out to get the other, they're out to help the other community, not you. And you go tell the other community, they're out to help the other community, not you. And the other way that is done is even openly to the same group of people, saying your opponent is doing two contradictory things, or you're going to do two contradictory things. Most common area for that happens to be financial. In the last campaign, my opponent had a, I think, fairly effective brochure. Fortunately, didn't get it out very well in the right ways, in the right places, but he had a real powerful thing suggesting that I was anti-education because I didn't vote to spend enough funds for education. I was anti-environment because I didn't vote to spend enough funds for environmental protection. I was pro-crime because I wouldn't spend enough for prisons and the correctional system and police and everything else. I was anti-senior citizens because I didn't fund nursing homes and a lot. There were about 8 or 9 things that I was I wouldn't spend enough funds on and so on because they weren't priorities of mine or because whatever. I just was screwed up jerk who didn't support any of these worthwhile causes that the public did support. And then, of course, the final thing was, but boy, does this guy raise your taxes a lot. And my response simply was, you can't have it both ways. I mean, I don't like taxes. I don't know anybody who does like taxes. And I also like to fund these things. And I think I'm being a responsible politician in the way I'm calling the shots on those. But here you've got an opponent out there who says you tax too much and spend too little. And then at the same time arguing we got a budget deficit and he's going to take care of that problem. How? Well, he's got 40 years of business experience and he can straighten out the books real quick. But I'd suggest that two-sided talk, both when it's done in a positive way, in favor of themselves about how he's going to do both these things better, or when it's negative, criticizing somebody else for that, is a negative cheap shot. Another way to do it is taking things out of context. A common way in which this is done is to take a vote. You may have a vote, say, on some environmental issue, and then there's going to be an amendment they know coming up that's going to toughen up the bill significantly. So they propose a compromise that doesn't really toughen it up significantly, but looks like it might, and then they can. And it's kind of an either-or option. You can go for one or the other, and you're going to go for the second once you vote against the first one. Then you portray that person. Look, they voted against this thing to toughen up this bill in this way. And you can easily portray a candidate as somebody who opposed what the actual context of the vote would have been. Makes it look like the person's on the opposite side of the issue from where they were. And that's a very frequent tactic. Often people force what they'd call tough votes on others, and everybody at the legislature knows it. Once a budget's put together, we're going to spend this much in this budget area, this much in this one, this much in this, and here's where the taxes are going to come from, and here's how much the taxes are going to be. Then they come in and offer both amendments to bills to say we're going to spend more for this and for this and for this, and then, boy, we're going to try and cut this tax back and cut this tax back. And in the end, if you want to have a balanced budget, which our state and most state constitutions require, you can't support them. Once you draw the line, you have to do it. So a minority party, and both parties, when they're in the minority, tend to do this. They come out there and offer these, quote, tough vote amendments to make the majority that has to put together a budget look bad. So they can suggest, and that's where my opponent can get some votes suggesting I vote against funding for education or whatever cause, and I vote for more taxes than I should, and all those things together. Sometimes, not only are things taken out of context, sometimes I'd argue there are outright distortions made. You find a kernel of truth in some way, shape, or form. Minnesota had a property tax relief system. We're a state with very high state taxes and lower than normal residential property taxes. One of the ways we've done that was we funded what's called a homestead credit. So you have your homestead taxes figured out, and then was several years ago $720 of your property taxes, roughly half of your taxes up to $1,400 would be paid off by a state homestead credit. Due to a number of reasons that the system wasn't working right, there was a proposal that passed that had relatively strong support from both parties to get rid of that and replace it with a different mechanism of funding it. There was actually an extra $200 or $300 million pumped into the property tax relief program. So there was more money in the program than there was originally, but the name of it was changed because it was no longer a homestead credit. It was a different kind of payment to the local governments to do that. And so several candidates went out and started saying, so-and-so repeal the homestead credit. Voted to repeal the homestead credit. That could cost you $720 more per year. And of course, it raises great fear in people, and may have had some impact on several races, despite a lot of newspaper editorials trying to clarify what really happened. Got to the point where a year later, the legislature came back and we didn't restore the homestead credit, but put the title Homestead and Agricultural Credit on the new thing, so people would say, oh no, they voted to restore the homestead credit, because so people couldn't use that as a future campaign tactic. But clearly it was an outright distortion. Not that it was meant to, it would be saying they took away the homestead credit, which is worth $720 per year, and your taxes are going to go up by that much. Of course they don't, they should have stayed roughly the same that year, but it's an easy thing to do. And finally, and one of the newest kinds of tactics that I've seen that I'd use as an argument is dirty campaigning, is to accuse your opponent of making a dirty campaign. Whether they are or are not, it's pretty effective because nobody likes a dirty campaign. They may listen to them, but you don't like it. And so if you know somebody's campaigning in a nasty way, you're going to vote against them. My first race, my opponent filed 3 days before the election. He didn't file it, but he put out a big flyer saying Fletcher files 6 criminal complaints against me. Didn't say what they were in the brochure, but he said that he wasn't planning to do it, but his campaign staffer said these were such serious violations that somebody had to put their foot down, and so he was reluctantly filing a complaint with the county attorney's office. And I never did find out what they were, other than to find out that he did remove the complaints a month later. But it comes out the last week, the last 2 days, so you don't really have a chance to respond in a race like that. I don't, in a metropolitan area, my district is too small to be able to afford television advertisements and so on. So about the main way we get things out are through mailings or other types of flyers and so on. There's no way in the world you can respond the day before an election when something comes out like that. So you have to hope that people see it as a last-minute attack. But the trick is to suggest your opponent's the one who's who's running the dirty campaign. And then they may think more positively of you for that reason or whatever. But it's a clever tactic, and I'm sure every year there are new things that people find out about, and they look at what other campaigns are doing and find out a new twist on them. That's the negative part of it. The other problems I'd suggest with our current one is there's no substance in the campaigns. Mentioned the other day in a talk about how average length of a sound bite on a television news network has gone down during just one presidential election cycle, from 84 to 88. The average time spent on a political quote in the presidential race in 84 was over 40 seconds. It was down to about 9 seconds in 88. That's the average. Granted, in 84, there were some very short ones, two-second ones, like Where's the Beef was a clever sound bite. And, but there, the average length of time given to a political candidate in a news bite, not in a news broadcast, because not every day do they have them, but it was 40-some seconds, and it dropped to less than a fourth of that in just 4 years. And with the 30-second television ads, which are the bulk of most campaign, larger campaigns, there's no time for substance there. I would argue that this lack of detail, no position papers by any candidate anymore, there takes away from any real discussion of the issues. And when you do have debates, I don't know if I'd call them realistic debates, and they don't follow up enough. One person asks it, and then each candidate gives a speech on it. It doesn't even have to be what the question's on, and very little follow-up there, and then, well, we don't have no any more time for that. We're going to go to something else. And we're talking one or two debates, and that's kind of the end of things. I don't think debates are going to ever be the entire solution to these problems, but I do think more debates and more substance debates would be a part of that. And finally, the fourth complaint about the way elections are run right now is the fact that nobody presents any vision. And I would suggest that's not just a matter of detail, spelling out where you stand on the issues, but it largely has to do with rather than pointing out where I stand and what direction I want to see the country or the state or the community go, it's pointing out what's wrong with the other guy. And I would argue that that is the biggest single cause of cynicism. People, when ads are meant to portray your opponent as the scum of the earth, if people buy half of that, they wouldn't want to vote for either one. What's the difference between the candidates? Well, I don't know, they both say they want to cut taxes, but taxes go up anyway. They both say they want to do this, but that doesn't happen. People get real cynical because of that, and I'd suggest we should spend less time telling people what's wrong about the other guy, even if they're the incumbent and have legitimate things to criticize. It's okay to criticize where they stand on things, but criticize them in the context of what you'd do different. Not say that they voted against this and that's a terrible thing, but suggest how you would do it. Not just that you'd, on that particular vote, you'd do this, but here's what I stand for. Here's where I want to see us go to. Why are campaigns run this negative way? Simple reason, it works. 1980 was the peak year, I think, for the negative ads. 8 or 9 incumbent U.S. senators were beat out of 33 or 34 running. You can run these things with these 30-second ads, often not paid for by the candidate, often some other group on behalf of that candidate. So the candidate isn't even involved, and they can deny any claim with them. Matter of fact, most of, they have to be independent of the person if it's not reported as their campaign expenditures, and And you can't make campaigning contributions to a person at large, so you run your own campaign on behalf of some candidate or attacking their opponent. And it can be real effectively done, and people learned that about 10, 15 years ago, and I'd suggest that's why it works. There certainly are exceptions to it. If a thing gets too outrageous or the media or somebody picks it up, in Minnesota this year we had an incumbent senator and challenger, both of whom were Jewish faith. The incumbent at the last minute sent out a letter to fellow members of the Jewish community suggesting his opponent wasn't a good Jew because he married a Protestant woman and were not raising their kids as Jews. That backfired, I think, everywhere. I mean, it was publicized widely, so it wasn't just in the Jewish community. And for all I know, some anti-Semitism came in there too then, suggesting that it could have even been that. But it backfired. It was too vicious and too obviously personal cheap shot at somebody. And those kind of things do happen, but the track record of negative ads has been very effective, and so candidates continue doing them. And it's easy to do. Several years ago, one of the changes in our property tax system and the way we fund local governments in Minnesota came about in May, and then in June there was an annual convention of our state league of cities, all the city officials from around the state meeting in an annual convention. Minority leader in the House came there and talked about the property tax relief bill and the funding of local governments, and asked people to raise their hands if they thought their communities had gotten the short end of the stick, if they were treated unfairly compared to everyone else. Almost everybody in the room raised their hand. But these are elected officials who are supposed to know what's happening. And everyone thought they were being cheated. City people thought they were being cheated at the expense of the suburbs or the expense of rural communities. Rural communities knew the metropolitan area was getting the bulk of it. And there are times when elected officials may all think they're getting the short end of the stick because the state may be cutting back on the dollars going into something like aid to local governments. But this was a year when the aid had been significantly increased. So they were getting more, but they were all convinced they were somehow or another, from what they read, getting the short end of the stick. If elected officials do, certainly the public at large can be, everybody's suspicious they're going to get cheated by government. The more cynical people become about government, which is easy to become, the more they think that people are out to cheat them some way or another, and the more they're willing to accept somebody saying, "Do you think you've been cheated?" "Oh yeah, yeah, I sure have." And so the more easily these appeals play out. A couple more things before opening it up for discussion. Why aren't there any prosecutions for negative stuff? There are occasionally. It's very tough, given the standards of proof in a civil suit like that. You have to show that the person intentionally distorted something. It's if they made an error. In Minnesota, the courts have ruled it has to both be material. It had an impact on the election, which you have to show, and also that it was deliberate. And basically, most politicians are pretty careful about how they do it. They make sure there's a vote to prove it. One of these tough votes that they make you cast to embarrass you in the next election, they can use that to prove that you opposed such and such. My opponent, every vote he said I voted to deny $10 million to the schools in this proposal. Oh yeah, that was true. I mean, there was a vote out there he could use for that. So there's a kernel of truth in every one of them. Sometimes you take a real vote and distort its meaning. Or you can take a quote or a statement, and that may not be accurate. And as long as you don't know it's inaccurate, and that I can prove you knew it was inaccurate, you can reprint that thing as much as you want and use it to prove your point. The first campaign I was running in, there was a summary in one of our papers of the hottest races in the legislature that year, and ours was picked, and I thought they described my my opponent in glowing terms. As soon as the incumbent dropped out of the race, my opponent eagerly jumped into the race. And former city council member in St. Paul, he was aggressive in doing this and so on. So meanwhile, I, a political newcomer, was endorsed in the race by my party. It wasn't that I eagerly jumped in the race, though I thought I did. I was just kind of endorsed in it by that. And my party was, quote, pouring cash into my uphill campaign. Minnesota has spending limits, which are voluntary. I was agreeing to them, to accept them. My opponent wasn't. He was the one spending more. His party gave him the limit the party could give him. Mine didn't. I called the reporter the next day and told him these things. I said, I don't think that's a very decent quote to give me, saying that my party's, quote, pouring cash into my uphill effort. And he said, oh, yeah, he thought it showed that the party thought I had some hope, and so they were pouring cash into it. I said, that's the kind of thing I can picture my opponent using in a brochure. Sure enough, a month later, there it is in the brochure, a comparison piece between the two of us. And in terms of being willing to stand up for what they support, he quoted a friend of his saying that he was real independent, thoughtful kind of guy, and I was bought by the special interest. My party was, quote, pouring cash into my uphill campaign, quotes the newspaper, so it's a fact. Even though he got more money from his party and spent more in the election overall, there's a kernel of truth to it. He quoted a newspaper, and yeah, the newspaper said it must be true. And so those kind of things make it difficult. I couldn't attack him. I couldn't ask for a response from the editorial board after this, saying that that's a cheap shot. It's kind of, you just have to live with it. If we want to change these things, and if you can't really prosecute in most cases or even get civil damages in these cases, what do we want in campaigns, and how do we get there? I think what we want is pretty obvious. We want more detailed discussion, less of the fluff, more of a vision of how things should be going, and how do we get there? That becomes the tough point, of course. If I had a perfect solution, and there wouldn't be, I mean, if I could get it passed in the legislature and could change the public's opinion about how it all ought to work, it would be a great, we could improve our democracy quickly. But of course, one can throw out ideas, and how you get there is a difficult thing. I'd suggest that everybody has some sort of a role in it. The public, most of you may be limited in your role in campaigns to the role of public who's trying to observe and trying to figure out what's happening and who you ought to support because of whatever. I'd suggest both demanding substance from both the candidates and the media. How many of us have ever asked both candidates in a race for their position papers on something? If anybody has, you probably haven't gotten them from both candidates. Most candidates don't put them out. Or if they do, it's a little bullet. Yeah, I oppose taxes. Or yeah, I support education. Not what you'd call in-depth, thoughtful position papers. Demanding it, if more and more people say, I want your position paper on such and such issue. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have one. Well, how am I supposed to know whether I support you or not? If people start asking that, I'll guarantee you candidates will start putting them together. And if they say the ones they get aren't substantive enough, ask further. I went to a campaign training workshop my first year I was running, and one of the people there, a research person who had worked at the legislature, advised candidates that, well, most new candidates think the first thing they have to do is put out position papers on every issue, and it really bothers them a lot because they haven't studied the issues in much depth yet, and they don't know where they stand on a whole lot of things, and it's a real tricky thing to do, and it takes a lot of time. And his simple advice was, don't waste time on them. Nobody pays attention to them anyway. Why bother? I went the opposite route. I figured, well, maybe if I put out some detailed ones, maybe people, even if they disagree with them, will be appreciative that they put them out. I put out about 20 pages of small type single-spaced issue papers. And I don't make any bones about the fact that the only person I think who read the whole thing, other than myself, was my opponent. I'll guarantee he read every word to find out what he could use against me. I don't think anybody else did, but nevertheless, I think a lot of, which I did a lot of, I carried a summary position paper, two sides small type, of a single sheet of paper, stuffed into a brochure with the photos and all the other stuff you put out in a brochure. And I, as you walk down the street during summer when people are tend to be outside on the porch step or something like that, you look back once in a while, you'd see somebody sitting there just reading the thing 5 minutes after you left. That's a good sign. If they spend 5 minutes reading position paper, yeah, they're not going to agree with everything on there. I don't think it would be much substance if they did. And yet I think I heard from so many people who said they appreciated somebody took the time to spell out where they stood on things. Even if they didn't agree with me, they were appreciative that I didn't take them for granted and assume they shouldn't know where I stood on those things. But the public can demand that, not only of the candidates, but also the news media. And second of all, you have a right to criticize cheap shots and attacks and so on. And it's a tough thing to balance. What if there's a candidate you support and you know you agree with them on more issues than the opponent and so on, and that candidate starts taking cheap shots at the other one, runs a negative campaign? Do you vote for the one you disagree with more to do it? Well, at a certain point, I mean, you got to balance those two things out. But I think we have to stand up and say, we don't find that acceptable. Even if we think both candidates are, even if we slightly prefer one to the other, maybe we should start saying, look, I'm so disgusted at the nature of your campaigns. I can't know for sure if I do support you more than the other guy. I think we have to factor that in. And certainly letters to the editor and things like that, criticizing cheap shots don't hurt. The news media, I'd say, has a more important role than public even. I think it has to do both of those two things, demand the substance and criticize the cheap shots. It should also report on an interesting way on the substance. Most of the newspapers in Minnesota, whether the bigger metropolitan papers or local community ones, have voters' guides before every election, usually a week before in the weekly papers and so on. And minuscule type on three or four questions they ask all the candidates, and they have a brief biography of the candidate and their response on each issue. Well, it's better than nothing, so I'm not going to criticize that, but I'd suggest reporting on a little more substance of, there was a debate last night and so-and-so said this and he responded this way and the other guy kind of ducked that, and reporting on that would be much more meaningful than what's in the papers right now. Make it interesting discussion of the substance. Instead, what the papers tend to focus on is the horse race aspect. Who's ahead? Who's gaining? Who's picked up what group's support? You look at the news coverage of the presidential elections the last two, three times around, I would care to guess three-quarters of the coverage is on who's gaining in what way, where they stand. So-and-so seems to be gaining momentum. So-and-so, a new poll released by so-and-so shows that the gap between these two candidates is drawn up to this amount. So-and-so picked up powerful support from such-and-such group. Look at how much coverage there is on the issues rather than on the race. And almost all the coverage is on the race. Why? Well, maybe it's our love for sporting events. Watch the TV news. We spend a lot more time on sports events than we do on political news. And this kind of makes it more like a political sporting contest. Papers should focus more on what the issues are than who's ahead. And finally, they should editorialize on campaign tactics, the same way I encourage the public to criticize negative stuff. The news media, some of our papers have done stuff analyzing political ads. And it's kind of editorial reporting because they're commenting in a way, judgmental way somewhat, and so, and that's maybe a step in the right direction, but editorial boards, when they consider their endorsement of a candidate, they should say, look, this guy's campaign, while we think this may be the better candidate, the campaign has been so bad, we're not going to make an endorsement in that race. I think the papers, news media has a responsibility in that area. And finally, where the candidates come in, and I'd suggest the candidates have the greatest role of all in this, they're the ones who have started making it this way, and the first of which is don't assume that the public is stupid. I've heard politicians argue in terms of talking to fellow politicians, both that never underestimate the intelligence of the voter, because boy, they're smarter than you think. And I've also heard others say never overestimate the intelligence of the voter and never write anything above an eighth grade level and so on. I tend to think that you kind of get out of people what you expect out of them. If you assume that people aren't going to pay any attention to substance, you don't give them any substance, they're not going to pay attention to it because there's nothing out there to pay attention to. I think that the voters are able to comprehend difficult choices. I don't think people really expect to be told that. They don't really believe it when somebody comes in there and says, we're going to cut your taxes and we're going to spend more on this and this and that. I think most people, they don't trust that anyway. I mean, common sense is that that doesn't all work out. They may want to hear that and so on, but if somebody's out there saying, look, it doesn't work that way, I think they accept that, and they accept that more readily than they accept the stuff that they see as hypocritical. The second thing I would urge candidates to do is appeal to the good in people. We can appeal to fear and hatred and greed, or we can appeal to generosity and kindness and other sorts of things, and I will argue that either of those kinds of appeals do work. Certainly the ones, as I mentioned earlier, to the negative, the baser instincts in us, do work, because fear is a powerful motivator in electoral behavior. People who are scared of things are going to vote to protect themselves from that fear. But I'd also argue that appeals to generosity and to the greater good and so on can... People aren't all selfish ogres. I mean, we all have selfish instincts and we all have generous instincts. And I think if you appeal to one or the other, I can picture some candidates going out there and saying, boy, I want to cut your taxes because so-and-so is just out there to take them away from you and use them for all kinds of bad things. And people say, yeah, who's better able to spend my money, me or the government? Everybody's going to respond that way, me. You can also have a candidate who goes out there, and not many do, and goes out and suggests, I think we care about our senior citizens, we want them to have decent care and health care and so on. And I think people of Minnesota, United States, or our community care enough about this that we're going to do it. I think that people respond positively to being told they're good people who want to care about others. So I'd suggest appeals to good can work as well as appeals to negative, and candidates should try it. Finally, explaining their vision, where they stand, and spelling out the details rather than spending their time attacking other candidates. I made it a point of not even mentioning my opponents' names in my elections. I figure it... it's a lot healthier to spend your time on where you stand rather than where your opponent does. And finally, when attacked, don't be shy about responding and asking the media to respond as well. If you think you're unfairly attacked, I'm not going to encourage somebody to do it in a way that's going to hurt their chances. I think it's stupid to do so. That wrecks the purpose of it. But I think if all other things are equal, if you think you gain a little bit by responding and pointing out that the ad was deceptive, I think in the long run, if you can, any way you can point out that something's deceptive or get the media to point it out for you, I think it helps improve the system. But I guess this basically spells out my attempt at showing what I think various people or the public or the media or candidates have to do to move us in the right direction. And I hope that stimulates some discussion and questions.
There was one in negative campaigning. I was thinking of the Minnesota governor's race. so then attacking one's sex life causes a reaction to... how good he can do the job. I wondered how you
thought
about that.
Okay. Yeah, Minnesota, last year's governor's race was a doozy, even if those of you from not from Minnesota may have heard some of it. And I guess I'll give a couple responses to that. First of all, how does one's personal life fit into the issues? and what I saw is happening last year. First of all, I don't think one's personal life is absolutely irrelevant to the political process, the same way that candidates are out there spelling out the family picture or whatever to show that they share common values with people, the same way that people do want to know where candidates are coming from. Do they share, is this a trustworthy person? Is this a kind person, a decent person? If they don't, in sexual affairs perhaps, if they're married and don't respect their spouse, do we expect them to respect others? So I think it's a legitimate thing for the public to consider. I would suggest that that it's only one way, and it's not always the best way of judging where somebody's character is and where their values are, and that sometimes a lot more attention should be paid to the issues. And frankly, there's last year's Minnesota's governor's race, very little attention was paid to the issues. It was a circus of all these other things. In the incident that happened last year, I would suggest the incumbent governor was attacking the challenger for failing to release his taxes and a whole bunch of things that I think were largely irrelevant to the campaign, and I would not argue was a good, I would not argue the incumbent was running a positive campaign. The challenger then, some young women came out and alleged that he had been swimming nude with them when they were little kids in his swimming pool, and this kept coming out day after day, and in the end, based on that and some woman who said she had had an affair with him through both of his marriages, he dropped out of the race. New candidate came in and clobbered the incumbent as well. And I would suggest what the public saw in that one in the end was, my sense is that the incumbent did not raise the sexual issues. It was other people who did it, who I think, whether they were right or wrong, I have my own suspicions, and I think it was a healthy thing that that candidate dropped out of the race at that point. I think that the results of the race basically showed that the public was disgusted at the whole mess. Not just that, but both of the candidates in it, and were pleased to take somebody new, anybody new who comes in the race 3 weeks before the election. I'm convinced you could have run almost anybody. And it was truly a vote for none of the above. I really think there was a lot of that. And people joke at times about how, you know, boy, give me another choice on the ballot. Candidate A, candidate B, or none of the above. And the fact that some people write in names like Mickey Mouse on the ballot suggests that people really are fed up. And I guess I'm not a proponent of putting on a blank none of the above on the ballot, but I think that may lead to more cynicism. But the public is rightly disgusted at that. And, well, I think certainly if this guy was swimming nude with his daughter and other young teenagers, I think that says something about his character and so on. I also don't think that that should, if it's true, I think he should have dropped out of the race. If it's not true, I don't know how he had a way to respond. It's a very tough situation coming out, especially when it did. And the thing that disgusted me was, before that there was no discussion of the issues. And certainly after that comes about, there's not going to be any discussion of the issues. It's the latest one on who's making what allegations and what counter-allegations are coming out. Boy, if I could pick a race that I'd love to just throw out everybody and start from scratch on, it would be that one. I don't think it was healthy for Minnesota. It certainly didn't help political debate, and certainly made the public more cynical about politicians.
There are two issues in the last campaign, especially in Montana, it's probably nationwide, that seemed to get maximum mileage and distortion, and that was the National Endowment for the Arts and gun control.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on those?
Okay. Sure. National Endowment for the Arts, being a national issue and so on, don't want to spend a lot of time on. But basically, that's an easy kind of, a lot of issues that you find more in campaigns nowadays, maybe tiny, tiny percentage of budget or whatever in terms of government use, but they're very emotional issues. And that's one of them. And is the National Endowment for the Arts a bunch of people with perverse sexual habits that are trying to promote their view of the world on others? National Endowment for the Arts has given tens of thousands of grants, and three or four of them have been controversial. And you can picture that being the kind of issue that gets a lot of play. I'm happy to go into that more if people want, but I'd suggest that it's basically a very small issue that gets undue focus in the campaign. I think it's a legitimate issue, how people stand on that and so on, but it's basically some candidates seeing it as a big thing. Flag burning's another one. How many flag burnings have there been in this country in the past 10 years? It's not like there's a rampage of tens of thousands of people. I mean, we got all kinds of power problems in this country, and how many flag burnings have we had? And yet, that was one of the hot issues of the campaign. On the issue of gun control, that's certainly one that's not just an issue in Montana. It's an issue in virtually every state, I will guess. And it's not a new one in the last election, and it's been around a long time. I'd suggest that's one of those issues where the politics of it and public opinion don't fall on the same side. I would suggest that, depending on the type of issue, California passed some assault rifle legislation banning the sale of certain particular models of assault rifles. If you poll the public on it, you'll have pretty close to 90% supporting such a ban. Politically, it's a hot issue that came up in Minnesota 2 years ago and failed to pass. Why? Well, people are scared of the politics of it. Why, if the public is 80-some percent in support of something, are they scared to vote for it? Well, the only people who pay attention to the issue are 10% on the other side. And that's been true for a long time on that issue. Again, not every gun control issue is 90% or 85% support for it. Most of them are much more like 60-40 kind of things. But in general, most polls in Montana may not be reflective of the nation as a whole, but the nation as a whole have had almost 2-to-1 margins in support of a lot of things like waiting periods for gun purchases, some kinds of registration types of proposals, and yet the politics of it are very much, the political pressure is very strong, and it becomes a very emotional issue too. I remember a postcard I got several years ago: if you vote for such and such bill, gun control bill, I'm watching, and I will spend every dime I can to defeat you in the next election. I thought, wow, this is a pretty powerful little postcard, and the guy signed his name. And, I heard one of my colleagues talking about something like this, and I checked with him. Yeah, and this same guy had said he was the constituent of about 10 members of the Judiciary Committee, and we all got the same postcard from the same guy, and I showed them to a reporter who got a kick out of that and wrote a little blurb about how this one guy lived in so many districts. But the political pressure is there. It was an effective scare to several people, I think, because they know people feel that strongly about it and will vote on that one issue. Again, I'd argue that the political courage one on that issue is to vote with where the public opinion is, because the public at large doesn't pay any attention to it, just that 5-10%.
Do you think the single issue politics and the negative campaigns are kind of growing up together? To me, the single issue politics have grown in the 80s, maybe as rapidly as negative politics.
They are growing up at the same time. I'm not sure if it's necessarily related. It's real easy to appeal in negative politics to single issue groups. Targeted mailings is not a difficult thing to do. You pick your issue, you know exactly where they are on the gun control issue. The reason it's such a powerful force of a single issue group is what you do is you take mailing lists to the NRA or some group such as that who is anti-gun control, and you just mail stuff saying how your opponent's whatever and you're a good guy on it, and it's overwhelmingly effective because you gain most of those votes because they are single-issue voters. I've seen candidates who, I know of one candidate who actually had a friend join the NRA, a friend living in his district joined the NRA, so he could get all the mailings from this group and so he could find out if they were doing anything to attack him. Then he said all he had to do was just get the flyer and reprint it and distribute it to every household in the district, it would win him votes. And single issue groups and negative attacks do work very well together, and many of those groups do fund such things very heavily. Single issue politics, I don't know if that's a new thing. I think it is. I think you're right that it's a growing trend. And I don't mind that people get involved on a single issue. I frankly think they're involved, and maybe the hope is that then they see not only is that issue important to them, but maybe some other issues ought to be important too, and people see that there's a broader kind of, that our government deals with virtually every aspect of our lives, and we ought to be concerned about more than one little issue. But I think you're right to a certain extent that the negative stuff is both funded by some single issue groups and the negative stuff works very well with single issue groups. Yes?
Regarding the media again, it seems that that's a real important aspect of political campaigns. And over the past 20 years or so, in my experience, the media has gone kind of from investigative journalism to now we have kind of a stenography pool there. And I wonder if that's not being used by the politicians, because they know they're just going to repeat exactly what they say, or is the media setting the tone, in your experience? I mean, are they setting the pace? Are they saying, we're going to write just what we want to write, and then so you kind of, you work with them on their terms, or are they following the politicians on that?
I don't know that I phrase it exactly right, because I don't think the media is intentionally, I don't know that they're following all the crud that the politicians are doing. I think that there is a lot of the media, a lot of their decisions on it are marketing kinds of things. What's most interesting to people, saying a candidate X feels this way about such and such healthcare issue and candidate Y feels that way about the same healthcare issue, is a lot less exciting than saying, oh, so-and-so gained a percent in the polls, now they're down by this much. I think a lot of it is the perception of what sells. What sells papers, what sells television ads. And I think that's real unfortunate, but I think that's part of it. And I wouldn't suggest necessarily that they repeat everything that candidates do at face value, but what's almost worse than that in my mind is that they kind of like the negative stuff. They kind of, hey, isn't this clever? I mean, they'll say how so-and-so is such a clever candidate, they got, what a brilliant advertisement this is. Nasty as can be, but boy, this is going to really appeal to this. And so I'm not sure that I'd phrase it exactly the way you did, in which they are basically just reporting word for word what they're hearing. I think they're watching it with interest and writing on it in a clever, interesting way, and they're very interested in the negative stuff too, only instead of criticizing it, they're saying, boy, this is, I mean, it's kind of like you get a plus for being vicious. That they're trying to promote something. I don't see the media as a conspiracy thing. I can tell you so many times when I think the media has really cheated me out of a decent coverage on a story, or they gave me unfair coverage. Hey, there are other times they've written things about me that they make me look better than I think they should. I mean, the media, I have a lot of gripes about the media, but I don't think it's direction is intentionally, I don't think the reporters are out there trying to bias an election that way. I think most of them try very hard not to do so. And they all have political beliefs, and I can sometimes figure them out. I've been wrong on some of them when I've found out somebody went to work for somebody of another party, and I thought, boy, that didn't, I would have guessed they were the other party. But reporters do have strong political beliefs, and a lot of them watch races more closely than, political reporters watch races more closely than the general public does and have strong opinions. But I wouldn't say the media at large is out there attempting to distort or bias the system. I heard somebody's watch beep, and it is 5 o'clock, so I better call an end to this. But I will be around here for a few minutes and happy to talk further, either right now or in the next couple of days. Thank you for coming.